Alright, so, the last time we, Matt, we were talking about the interstellar medium. So that's, right, the stuff between the stars, and mostly we're talking about, fairly low density gas of really any variety, but primarily just by mass, that's going to be made up of hydrogen and helium, same as pretty much everything else. Stars, you know, are also primarily hydrogen and helium. Then some small percentage by mass of things like higher mass molecular gases and metallic rocky dust things. So we left off, we were talking about the different states that hydrogen can be in. Up to now, we had talked about ionized hydrogen, which is hydrogen that's had an electron removed from it by some process, and we were talking about sort of temperatures and ways that we can see these different phases of hydrogen, and the ionized hydrogen is best seen from emission lines as electrons sort of randomly recombine and cascade down and emit lines out. So you can sort of see the invisible light in the Balmer line series, the emission lines at the sort of the red and blue parts of the spectrum. And then the last thing we got to before we ran out of time was talking about neutral hydrogen, which of course is hydrogen with an electron in it. This is found in regions of sort of middle-ish temperature when it comes to the interstellar medium, things that are cool but not very cold, sort of in the hundreds of Kelvin range, sort of room temperature-ish. But you might think of, you know, you would find neutral hydrogen in this room. It's not hot enough to ionize, but it's that sort of thing. And we were talking about how we see neutral hydrogen. And so this is where we left off, saying that mostly the electrons that you find in the hydrogen are in the ground state. Yes, Sophia?
What was the third thing? There was neutral ionized
and molecular hydrogen. Sorry, we'll come back to that
okay.
in a few minutes. Neutral hydrogen is mostly found in the ground state, right? It's at the N equals 1. The electron is in the lowest possible energy state. But really what the trick is with hydrogen is that the N equals 1 state actually has two smaller states sort of right next to each other in energy, which has to do with the spin of the proton and the electron. So if we sort of draw out a diagram here, if we have a bigger circle equal to the proton and the small blue circle equal to the electron, you have two possible options for both of these particles in the hydrogen atom. They could be spin up or spin down. So you can sort of imagine, right, if something is spinning, you imagine the right-hand rule, right? If you're looking down on top of it from up above, if it's going counterclockwise, the spin is pointing up. If it's going clockwise, the spin is pointing down, right? So both the proton and the electron can have spin up or spin down. And the true ground state in this hydrogen atom here is when the spins are opposite to each other. So one is up and one is down. That's the lowest possible energy state. So it doesn't matter which one is up or down, as long as they're anti-aligned, right? They're opposites from each other, then you're in the true ground state. But you can have, sometimes, randomly, you can flip the state of the spin of one of those particles to the up to the other way around. So they'd be up, up, or down, down, right? And in that case, the energy of that atom is then a little bit higher than it was in that true ground state of up, down. Sophia?
So you said it doesn't matter when they're opposite. You said it doesn't matter which is which. What about when they're both aligned? Does it matter if it's both up or both down?
No. It's really just that they're aligned or not aligned. So because the aligned up, up, down, down, have a little bit more energy than up, down, or down, up, depending. Then when you transition randomly back to the unaligned spins, you have a little bit of energy that you can bleed off in the form of an in a photon. And so we talked about how the ionization energy that you need to completely remove the electron from the hydrogen atom is 13.6 eV. The amount of energy that you have in the difference between these two states is 6 × 10⁻⁶ eV. So just like a tiny little difference, right? A micro eV. And so if you translate that energy for that photon into a wavelength, remember that the wavelength, the energy of an atom, the energy of a photon is equal to some constants, the speed of light times the Planck constant divided by the wavelength. If you translate that energy into a wavelength, that's a wavelength of 21 centimeters long. So a little less than a foot, right? A foot is about 30 centimeters. So, you know, yay long, 21 centimeters. And that's found in the radio part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So if you take a big, you know, dish, a radio telescope, and look for light at a wavelength of 21 centimeters, this is an emission source of 21 centimeter light. So you'll be able to observe directly where all the neutral hydrogen is out there in the universe. Plus or minus redshift, right? So if things are moving towards or away from you, that's going to change exactly what wavelength that's at. But you, if you're looking for a sort of in that range, 21 centimeters, you'll be able to find where the hydrogen gas is in the neutral state.
David. Is it hard to detect things with longer wavelengths since they have such low energy?
Is it harder to?
Yeah. Because I feel like, I don't know, just intuitively it makes sense. Like, to me it makes sense that like if there's a low amount of energy, it'd be harder to detect. And like, it makes sense because there's lots of hydrogen, but.
I would say like, that the limiting factor is not necessarily the energy of the photon, but the number of photons that are coming towards you that you have available to collect.
And since there's lots of hydrogen.
Since there's lots of hydrogen out there, this is emitting lots of photons, so it's relatively easy. This is sort of, really the main issue with this is disentangling it from all the other sources of hydrogen, because there's so much of it out there that, you know, if you're looking along a particular direction, you're going to say, well, which blob of hydrogen am I looking at here? Is it the one that's moving a little bit further away from me or a little bit closer to me? You know, those distance is the main problem here, is figuring out where it is along that direction versus whether it's there. So this is going to be a pretty useful tool, right? This is because of the temperature that we're looking at for this particular phase, right? We're looking at things that are in the sort of hundreds of Kelvin range. This isn't going to be in places that are particularly close to hot environments, things like hot stars or recently formed stars. This is going to sort of be the sort of the baseline in between. This is where the big distribution of gas is that could eventually become stars. And it's sort of, you know, if we're talking about temperatures here, right, as you go from hot to cold, you're getting sort of more dense as well. So ionized hydrogen, if you sort of think about the ideal gas law, right? Ionized hydrogen is the least dense of these things. So close by, things get, they heat up and they sort of expand, they get to lower density. Neutral hydrogen is sort of in between, and that means molecular hydrogen, which is at the coldest environments, sort of in the tens of Kelvin range, is going to be the most dense of this, of these three forms of hydrogen. Not least also because it's two protons together instead of just one by itself, right? So you have double the amount of mass here in an even colder environment, so it's even more dense than just by temperature. Sophia. Think of the ideal gas law, right? So as temperature gets lower, the density has to get lower to keep the same. Yeah. So we're going to find molecular hydrogen in the coldest environments, but there's a problem with molecular hydrogen in that it doesn't have an easily visible emission spectrum of its own, right? One of the ways that you can change energies, we talked about spin in the proton-electron way. Molecules also have spin. So depending on, they have rotational spin, sort of vibrations, right? That you can think of, things are spinning, things are sort of acting like a spring, or like a hinge. And those are different ways that molecules can change their energy over time and emit light. For the H2, two protons together, atom, none of those are in the visible part or radio part of the spectrum. They're all very difficult to observe from the surface of the Earth. So we need to think of other ways to look for where we will expect to find lots of molecular hydrogen. And one of the ways that we do that is by looking at other molecules that will exist in those low temperatures. This is generally true of most molecules, is that they are very unstable at higher temperatures. So looking for things that can only exist in cold environments are going to be more likely to lead you to that molecular hydrogen. So one of these is carbon monoxide. Or CO, which emits light particularly at 2.6 millimeters. So, you know, that long. That's also sort of in the microwave radio part of the spectrum, so you can go out and look at that. Dust. Right, that's also going to be in cold, dense environments. It's going to cluster down in the cold parts. You can look for dust as well. And then really sort of lots of other molecules. Ray, do you remember some of off the top of your head what some of the other molecules that we use?
Hydrogen cyanide.
Ammonia. Which NH3. I don't remember. What? NH3. Thank you. Right, so there's different things that you can, I don't remember what wavelengths those are at, but dust is going to absorb light from behind it, right, so it sort of blocks out light. But these are all possible ways of finding, and so for all of these, there's going to be some relationship between the amount of that molecule that you see and how much molecular hydrogen you expect to see. Sort of they follow a relationship. So this is the best way to detect the molecular hydrogens, by looking at things that aren't that thing at all, which is kind of counterintuitive. Yeah.
Sorry, what did you say the 2.6 was?
That is the wavelength that carbon monoxide emits at. Sophia?
And is that emission due to like some of the rotational vibrations?
Something like that. I don't remember exactly what the... But you know, you can sort of imagine like the H2O molecule, the oxygen is in the middle, and it has sort of a
triangle.
angle shape, 235 degree-ish shape, right? So if that sort of wiggles like that, that's producing light at some point. It's something like that for CO2. Or like a twisty thing, or there's all sorts of different ways molecules can vibrate. So the molecular hydrogen is the stuff that is the most dense, and it's also the stuff that's the coldest. But the problem with that is that if we want to form stars out of this stuff, right, stars have to get hot to be able to fuse hydrogen into helium, right? But it also needs to be dense to get enough material in there to actually get hot enough to start that fusion process. So you have to start from molecular hydrogen form a star. But it's the coldest stuff. So how do we go from a little nugget of cold gas to a star that's fusing hydrogen into helium over time? It's a rhetorical question for now, but Sophia.
So you said we to like make a star, we start with molecular hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what is the exact reason for that? That's the most abundant?
Because you need to collect lots of mass to start to be able to get eventually the temperature high enough.
So we just use the most dense one, or?
So the most dense one is going to provide enough gravity to start pulling in mass from other places to get to that threshold mass that you need to start.
Would you know, like, the factor, like, about how much denser molecular hydrogen is?
I was actually about to write down a table of a comparison here. So yes. If we're sort of imagining what the density differences are here, so if we talk about comparing a sort of a cloud of neutral hydrogen, H1, which is sort of diffuse and it's not really dense enough to reach that star mass there. And the densities that will be required to get over that threshold mass to form a star. So we're going to be calling that what is a molecular cloud core. If we look at temperature, density, and mass, if we sort of imagine what the schematic diagram looks like here, we'll have we're going to have both kinds of hydrogen in a single object, but what we'll have is an outer layer of more diffuse neutral hydrogen, and then a central clump of molecular hydrogen inside of it. Something sort of like this. So, this is a little counterintuitive for what I just said about how neutral hydrogen will be a little bit warmer than molecular hydrogen, but this is sort of a little bit. This is not separated out into separate things. This is together into a single thing. And so the temperature of the neutral hydrogen cloud is about 50 Kelvin, while the core, the molecular cloud core, is 150 Kelvin. So it's actually warmer in the center than it is on the outside with the neutral hydrogen. And the reason behind that is because you can sort of imagine, right? You all thought of yourselves as forming this molecular cloud, right? If you all jammed together in the center of the room, the temperature would go up, right? Because you're bumping into each other, right? There's lots of collisions happening. That's going to raise the average particle speed of all of you, right? As you try to find a comfortable position, while as people on the outside of the room have more room to work with, and they're going to be a little bit cooler because they can stay still. So that's why it's hotter in the center, because it's denser, things are rubbing against each other, they're bumping into each other, and that raises the temperature. So the density in these two different places, in the outer regions you have 500 particles per cubic centimeter. In the center, in the molecular cloud core, you have 10 to the 8 particles per cubic centimeter. So it's a lot denser. That's sort of approaching sort of star density there. Sophia?
So like just to, like I'm trying to explain to myself like the temperature.
Yeah.
So is it correct to say like by itself the neutral hydrogen is warmer than the molecular hydrogen, but like the amount by which the molecular hydrogen is denser just outweighs
because things are close enough to bump into each other and increase the temperature that way.
I'm confused because here it's denser and hotter, but you said normally if it's denser, it's colder. Like what makes it different?
Right, so there is some threshold density where once you pass sort of a line, things are close enough to each other that they get hotter. Think of the sun, right? As you get closer to the center, as the density goes up, the temperature also goes up. That's because of those collisions, right?
Okay.
So at the density where things are colder when they're more dense, they're still not dense enough for lots of collisions
okay.
to happen. So it's a sort of a collisionless versus a collisional gas, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So as you sort of, as you pack things more into each other, there's more chance for collisions to happen and that heats it up. But at those higher, bigger sizes, lower densities, those collisions will happen. So temperature is measured a little bit differently. David?
So does that mean that the energy of stars just comes from the collisions between different particles in like getting particles?
Yeah. And then in stars, right, things, then you start to think about it a different way where you have charged particles trying to get too close to each other. Right, and then they're repelled by the Coulomb repulsion force.
But is it the collisions that make that like helps form the star, like the transition between a cloud and then into a star? Is that what happens?
Collisions will be helping to heat it up to get to the required temperature.
Yeah, and then once it gets to that point, then it can actually start.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll go through the whole. There's lots of steps in between here and there.
Yeah.
Sophia.
This is kind of like Joanne's question. So here in the cloud and
yes.
the two clouds, denser is hotter.
Yes.
But when they were individual, denser was colder.
Yes.
And so there's like is it kind of like this? Like with temperature and density, like first increase in the density like decreases the temperature and then once you get to like a critical combination of the two.
Yeah.
Like visual.
Right. So we'll draw that graph, right? So if we draw density on the x-axis and temperature on the y-axis, it would look something like this, what we're talking about here. So the mass of these two different parts are also, right, if you have a much bigger density for the molecular cloud core part, you're going to imagine that you're going to have a lot more mass contained in sort of the seed at the center of this cloud, right? So the bigger, more diffuse part contains somewhere between 1 and 100 solar masses, and the molecular cloud core has somewhere between 10 and 1,000 solar masses. So if you can imagine sort of there's a total mass, sort of roughly 10% of that is contained in the more diffuse part, and 90% of it is contained in the dense part of the second. Hear it?
So based off the density of mass, like this cloud is extremely massive. There's only 500 particles
yes.
in a cubic centimeter. Could be almost 100. talking about a little, you know, a small thing here. We're talking about
a large
cloud, right? So if you can sort of imagine, right, if you're looking at one of those star formation regions over there, we're talking about sort of the end, right, the sort of the top, the tip of the pillar there. That's going to be containing sort of this large amount of mass. Those are light years across, right? They're big.
So what's going to happen to, oh, sorry, Sophia.
So since mass is like an extrinsic property, like it's just I'm a little confused about like how it's on there. So is that like for the average?
Right, so these are molecular clouds, right? They're going to be somewhere in that range of mass, depending on conditions. It's sort of random, somewhere in that range. And so, to be clear, right? When we're talking about the molecular hydrogen here in the core, we're talking about all these other things that go along with it are also found there too, right? There's going to be dust in there. There's going to be all these other molecules are going to be found there until things start to heat up, and then things will change in terms of the composition. So, right, what we're seeing in that picture back there, right, the dark parts, that's the dust that's found in these molecular cores. So what's going to happen to this, right? How are we going to go from this sort of blob of gas and turn it into a star, right? What are the steps going to be? As with a star, right, there's pressure here keeping this cloud from collapsing down in and of itself, right? And that's provided by the thermal pressure from the temperature there. Remember your ideal gas law, right? As you try to jam things down, the pressure pushes back. So in this sort of temperature where things are in equilibrium, we're sort of in this range of sort of 50 to 150 Kelvin of thermal pressure keeping things from collapsing down under the gravity of what's in that cloud. If we go back and sort of imagine, what would we have to do? What would the conditions have to be to start this cloud on a collapse trajectory? How much pushing would we have to do to make that collapse start? If we go back and we consider, we talked about something called the Virial theorem. I hope that phrase rings a bell, hopefully. Sophia is nodding. Garrett looks like he doesn't remember, so we'll call it a coin toss. It's fine, we'll talk about it real quick. The Virial theorem. Theorem says that the kinetic and potential energies of a system have to add up to zero, right? So you have to sort of conserve energy between potential energy and kinetic energy. And when you work out, the specific part that the Virial theorem says is that the total energy is equal to 1/2 of the potential energy, which means that the kinetic energy is equal to 1/2 of the potential energy. If you say that they have to add up to zero, right, and then you have to have, the math works out, right? So if this is true and we have thermal pressure going on, the kinetic energy is equal to the density of the gas times 3/2 kT. So this is the thermodynamic energy, kinetic energy from a gas of a particular temperature. And the potential energy for a sphere is equal to negative 3/5 gm squared over r. So if you set these two things equal to each other, right, saying k plus u equals zero, you have three nkt equals 3/5 gm squared over r. Where did the two go? It's because of this thing here. So one of them goes away because it's half of that. So this is when this cloud system is in balance, right? There's pressure pushing out, gravity pulling in. So if we want that's a 2. That's a squared, not a weird squiggle. That was not even remotely close to looking like a 2. If we want to cause this cloud to collapse, right, one of these things has to get bigger. One of them has to be smaller. So we want to say there's a condition here where the amount of pressure that you have from thermal equilibrium is less than the amount of gravitational potential energy you have. And that would cause the cloud to start to collapse because there's more gravity pulling in and there's pressure pushing out. So if we take out this equal sign here and make it a less than symbol, if the thermal pressure is less than the gravity, that cloud will start to collapse. Right, the same way the sun would, right? If the sun got too cold, it would shrink down because there wouldn't be enough pressure pushing back out, right? In the core of the star. So what we can do then is, based on this, is solve for what mass you need to be at to reach that condition. So we have to define a couple other side terms here to do that. One is that the density of the cloud, N, is just going to, we're going to say that's equal to the total mass divided by the individual particle mass to get the number density. Right, that just tells you how many particles there are. And then true to form, I've written a number here, a letter that I can't read my own handwriting, which is really helpful. I think that's a N. And then the radius of the cloud that we're talking about, this is useful for inserting here at the bottom, for R, is going to be equal to 3n divided by 4 pi rho to the 1/3. Alex? The number of particles that there are. Sophia?
I'm just confused. Is n the total number or the number density?
The total number. I misspoke a few seconds ago. It's the total number of particles. So basically, you can imagine, right, if you take, this is coming from the volume of a sphere, you know how many particles you have a total mass. And so you can say there's a density there, and then 4/3 pi r cubed gives you that's where this comes from, rearranging.
So like that rho is a number density?
That rho is a number density, yeah. Joanne?
Can you say what the m's are again?
total mass divided by particle mass.
Okay.
So that, right, so if you have a total mass and you assume they're all the same particle, then that gives you a total number. So if we insert those two things back in and do some rearranging, we're left with that mass, when it's greater than 5kT divided by gm, where m is the particle mass, to the 3/2 times 3 over 4 pi rho to the 1/2. This is called the genes mass, named after the person who figured it out. Not like blue jeans, but some British guy, I think. So you'll note, right, that there are sort of only two quantities here that really can change in a cloud of gas, right? The temperature and the density. And then this is just the particle mass. So it's, you know, we're saying it's still made of protons, hydrogen, right? That's not going to change. If the mass of your total cloud gets bigger than this, collapse will start, right? That cloud will start to shrink down. But as it shrinks down, temperature and density will change. Right, so you have to sort of get to a particular, you'll follow a path here, right, where sort of things will sort of slowly go as they sort of step through conditions that will start to shrink slowly down. But this mass will also change depending on what the temperature and density are, right? So you'll sort of start and stop, collapse as you change the temperature and density. Should we go? Sorry, that's a little M. I will rewrite that more clearly. So GM subparticle is how you should read that. Hear it.
So if you reach that mass, it will begin to collapse, not at a constant rate, but there's no chance that it will like no longer be at that mass.
So this is the thing, right? Is that different parts of this cloud if you sort of sample this cloud into smaller bits, different parts of the cloud can be over or below this mass at the same time. So what will happen is the cloud will sort of fragment, if that makes sense. So if you imagine that it's not a smooth density, it's sort of a lumpy, bumpy, clumpy, bag of marbles or something, I don't know. Different parts of the cloud will start to collapse at different rates, and that cloud will collapse, it will fragment into smaller pieces, and each of those will continue to collapse and fragment, and it sort of splits up into smaller bits. Does that answer your question, Gary? Maybe. I don't really remember how you phrased your question, but. Okay. So, Sophia.
So, like, since it's just kind of weird, like, for me, because the M is, like, an extrinsic, you know, like, the temperature and density, you can have the same temperature and density for different, like, sizes of the mass. That's not how mass works. So the way I'm imagining this is that you have like this cloud, and then you could draw like a random like circle and say, oh, in this area with the density that's there, the temperature that's there, and the mass that's in that area, like it will be at that critical mass or not. You could draw a different circle, and then in some circles it will be at that, and some it won't, and that will break apart.
Exactly. And so that region where you've exceeded that limit, that part will collapse down while a different part of the cloud isn't at that point yet.
That is cool.
It is cool. And so that's how you take a big cloud of gas that's maybe a few thousand solar masses and turn it into a bunch of stars. Because each one of those different regions is going to happen at a slightly different pace. The important thing to remember here, right, is when you exceed this limit, maybe part of the cloud can collapse, or the whole thing can. It depends, right? It depends on the conditions. So, if we imagine how this collapse might happen, right, in sort of a more theoretical, ideal way. Right. What I said was it'll sort of happen in starts and stops as things change, right? But we can say, what if we hold one of those things constant? What if we say the temperature will stay the same, for example, and let the density increase over time? That's actually a reasonable assumption, because at these are still lowish densities on the outside. That gas will be optically thin, meaning that radiation can easily make it out of the cloud, which means that as you collapse down, the heat you're generating from getting denser can radiate away and keep the cloud the same temperature. So this would be called an isothermal collapse. Isothermal meaning same temperature, right? So if you can sort of imagine, if you draw out what this might look like, we have some axes here. If we imagine that this is time along the x-axis, if we sort of sketch out what the radius of this cloud will do as we go through an isothermal collapse, it will sort of more or less do something like this. It will sort of slowly coast down, and then it will turn over and start to speed up. Because what's happening is the density is sort of slowly increasing and then increasing all at once. So if we sketch out density, it would do something like this. Right? Sophia? Radius, and blue is density. Strictly speaking, it's the log of the density. Wouldn't do that in regular density, but. So this is what we would call a free fall, right? Sort of, sorry, Sean, do you have a question? Yes, it will do that. And that's when the star formation process starts, right? So this is the sort of the step zero to star formation, is getting things to the point where they're no longer optically thin. And then you can push back against that collapsing under gravity. Steve?
Is this clumping why there are so many binary systems?
Yes. Because things are, you know, you get to the point where you have two regions right next to each other.
Right.
They're close enough that they can stay bound to each other, and then they are in a binary system. Shanti?
About how far away are the binary systems?
Binary, see, that's a kind of a hard question to answer, because binary systems can sort of be any size. They just have to be gravitationally bound to each other. So you can be really close, or you could be really far away and have a really, really long period. Or you could be sort of Earth orbit sized. It just depends on the mass, on the what else is out there. Because it's a complicated sort of n-body problem. Sophia.
Is the reason that it's important when it's no longer optically thin because then the heat is kind of trapped and then just keeps increasing the heat and the density?
Yeah. And then you have a runaway reaction and it can get hot enough to, yeah. We're getting there. I like the instinct though, that's good. You guys are on the right track. We can also ask what the free fall time is, right? How long will this collapse take from start to finish? Once you exceed that threshold mass, how long will it take for you to get down to the point where you reach optically thick and sort of stop your collapse? So that's what we call the free fall time. If you sort of imagine working out the acceleration due to gravity on a particular particle at some distance away from the mass, right, you can say basically acceleration is equal to gm over r squared, where m of r here is asking sort of for mass inside a radius, right, so things outside won't affect it anymore. So you can sort of imagine a particle falling through and not worrying about the rest of the cloud that's around it still. If we step through, we won't do the details just in the interest of time here, but basically you step through, you find that acceleration is equal to 4/3 pi g r radius of the cloud times the density of the cloud. That's the mass part here. If you assume a constant acceleration, right, you're sort of at your terminal velocity, right? You don't change how fast you're accelerating. David?
Yeah, all those variables are in the numerator. Is that equation?
Yes.
It's just the 4/3. It's just like...
Yeah. Like that, yeah. If you take that and turn it around, that's your acceleration. If you say that the distance you go is equal to 1/2 times the acceleration times your free fall time squared. If you work out what this is, you get that the free fall time goes as the square root of 1 over g times the density. Like that. So as you crank up the density, the time it takes for that collapse to happen gets shorter. And so that's sort of why it's doing this, right? Where you go, you start out slow and then you go fast all at once. As the density goes up, it just all happens. So basically what's happening is, right, we have two competing effects here, is how fast the collapse is happening and how much mass we have there to trigger that collapse to happen in the first place. So if we have free fall time, goes as the square root of 1 over g times rho, and we have that mass that we're looking at, our threshold mass, right? If we have a constant temperature, we'll just say for our isothermal collapse, then we have 1 over density to the 1/2 again here too. So as we're increasing the density, we're making the free fall time get shorter, and we're decreasing the mass that we need to trigger the collapse. Right? So all those little regions separate out from each other and keep collapsing down in on themselves, right? So you take a big cloud, and pretty quickly, you imagine all the little lumps in that are a little higher density start to collapse down, and they all just separate out and form a bunch of little clumps that collapse down, maybe break up a little bit more, and they create sort of a cloud of collapsing bits of gas. Sophia.
And then, like, many of those clumps clump together to form a star, or
each individual one will form a star. So we're fragmenting our cloud into smaller pieces. And each individual piece will each collapse down to form an individual star, or a binary star, maybe. Yes, Sophia.
So this process of, like, you have a kind of like a big, large volume of, like, a diffuse material, and then with, like, the interaction between temperature and density, like the, like, push and pull between the pressure and the gravity, starts collapsing. Like,
right.
Is that like analogous to, like, earlier in the history of the universe, like how stars and galaxies were created in the first place? Like, is that analogous also to just, like, galaxies? Like, you could say, like, a star is like a galaxy, and, like, the galaxies clumped out of, like, the whatever the medium was back then.
Galaxies sort of follow the same general principle, I guess, but
not all pressure, I guess, but
galaxies actually will be happening sort of more or less in reverse, where you have small lumps that come together to form a big lump of the galaxy. But stars are taking a big lump and fragmenting down from smaller bits. That makes sense.
Yes.
So they're sort of in reverse. If you imagine a tree, right, a trunk splits into smaller twigs and branches, that's what's happening with the cloud of gas to form stars. The galaxy is branches coming together to form a trunk.
Yes. I guess I was
in terms of mass.
I guess I was thinking, like, the stars in a galaxy would be analogous. Like, this is not direct, but the stars in the galaxy would be analogous to the particles in the star, because they're just, like, coming together based on gravity, like, clumping.
Yeah.
And like, the clumping is based on just, like, the slightest mismatch in, like, conditions, right? For both?
Just, yeah, little variances in density.
Right, in density.
However they happen. So one of the things we have to think about here is we have, if you can imagine, you have a cloud of gas sitting there. It's got its density and its temperature. It's in equilibrium. It's not collapsing. What triggers that? I mean, if you're not adding mass, if you don't have a source of temperature to heat it up, or cool it down, or change the density? How do you trigger that collapse to happen? Quantum fluctuations. I mean, I guess that's possible. Let me talk about it for a second. How would you, if you have a cloud sitting there, sort of floating around the galaxy without any mass being tacked on, how would you, what do you have to do based on what we have here? What do you have to do to that cloud to get it to start? Start that process. Push it over that threshold mass.
Can it have interactions with other stuff, or are we assuming there's no interaction?
It could.
Okay. So maybe it's okay.
Talk about it for a second. What are some ways you imagine you could do that?
Maybe, like,
interactions are possible.
Yeah.
All right, any ideas? Steve, what did your group talk about?
Well, so there's not a lot going on in this cloud besides just stuff is there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kind of agreed, you just kind of wait for gravity to bring everything together. If they're all hanging around at a party, you know, they'll eventually talk to each other.
Okay, just sit and wait. I mean, yeah, sure, yeah. Things can rearrange in themselves internally, and you can, you know, have a little seed that eventually will.
Yeah, that's
it. Might take a long time.
But how far we got
to get there, Albert? Something inside the cloud can rearrange into like a disk or something. Yeah, that could work too. Eventually. Sophia?
Like a little gravitational perturbation from like a large object somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, what if you took a black hole and threw it through the cloud? That would probably do something, right? What if you bumped two clouds into each other? That'll probably increase the density. I mean, one of them is just like torque from the galaxy. As things orbit around, one side is a little bit closer to the center than the other, and so it just sort of gives it a little squeeze.
You said torque from the galaxy or from the cloud?
From the galaxy. You know, just it's orbiting around, it's just going to give it a little bit. And that will give it just enough.
So we're collapsing down, right? If we can sort of imagine that you can keep separating things out as you know, having this threshold mass, you know, things can cross that mass, cross that density. The smallest you will go, the smallest fragmentation that can happen will leave an individual particle on the order of about a half solar mass, is the smallest bit you can have. So if you, a half solar mass is the smallest bit you can get out in terms of total mass.
The smallest clump you can have?
Yeah. So you can imagine if you have 1,000 solar mass cloud, that gives you, if you collapse them all down, about 2,000 individual clumps. At most, right? And in each one of those little clumps, eventually you get to the point where the density is high enough that the opacity goes from optically thin to optically thick. And that stops the free fall collapse from happening, right? There's no longer an isothermal collapse. Because once you reach that point where the cloud is too opaque, the temperature will no longer stay the same as it gets smaller. So this is called adiabatic collapse. Which basically means as you increase the temperature, you increase the pressure in the inside. And so now we have the conditions that we need to actually start to turn on a star here. So, let's see. Oops. let's look at what these, what the distribution, oh, sorry, what the distribution of sizes is for stars. If I can find it, as usual, if I can find it. Boo. Talk amongst yourselves for a second. Really? All right, well, I'll just have to draw it out. Part of the problem is that I came in with like 35% battery on this thing, so I'm like at 10% now, so can't turn the internet back on or we will run out of time. Okay, so let's imagine we have some axes here. We have the mass along the bottom in solar masses, and then along the vertical axis we have the number of stars in a given mass bin. And I guess we'll do this in sort of log space, so that we have log of mass and log of the number, right? So if we have one solar mass, 10 solar mass, 100, 0.1, 0.01. And then, let's see, 1/110, 1/100, 10, 100. So basically what we have here is that we sort of have a graph where if we have for every 100.1 solar mass stars, we have 10 1 solar mass stars, 1, 10, and then as we get to 100, we're like way down here. This is more or less what the distribution looks like for the mass of stars. So for every sort of one solar mass star, you have 1/10 of a 10 solar mass star and 1/100 of a 100 solar mass star. So for every 100 suns, you have 10 solar masses and 1/100 solar mass star, right? It sort of follows that slope there. This is what's called the initial mass function. And this is basically reflective of the size of the clouds that we're fragmented into, right? So you have lots of little half solar mass ones, and then a few tiny fractions of you know, you have one big one left at the end, basically. So this is one cloud that over, you know, say a few million years or something, has collapsed down to form this large number of stars following this pattern of the initial mass function, the number of stars at each given mass, all sort of in the same place. And so this is what's called a star cluster, right? Once you've formed all the stars, they all live in the same place. They're all sort of still gravitationally bound to each other on a large scale. So this is what a star cluster might look like. This is actually two star clusters next to each other. I'll make it big enough so it's... So this is two separate clusters, right? There's one here, and there's one here. And then sort of everything that's not in those two circles are foreground or background stars. So if you sort of look, right, each one of those two clusters formed from a different cloud of gas following that same pattern of initial mass function. All these stars are at the same rough distance from us. They were all born at the same time, plus or minus a million years or so. So what do you notice pattern? What's the pattern that you notice here? What do you see about the star's color? What does that mean for the star's like spectral type? Where is it on the AHR diagram, right? Brightness, what sort of patterns do you see in brightness? Distribution, like density, like sort of projected density. Talk about it for a second. See if you can come up with any trends in this picture. I think it loaded in, yeah. It's a big picture file. These two are probably closer nearby stars, probably like M dwarf main sequence stars, possibly, or like background red giant stars, and then maybe one of these is
one of the top as well.
I would say any red thing probably isn't a member of them. The bright ones, anyway.
Because
they're probably either faint and much closer or bright and much further away.
But like because of the color, or
because of the color. So they're either really low mass main sequence stars or really or higher mass giant stars.
Yeah. How would you be able to tell if it's like just a bunch of really close? Because are they white or are they blue, or like, how do you know if it's just a bunch of really close white dwarfs or far away giants?
That's a good question, and part of the answer is homework 5.
Okay.
Oh.
How do we know that they're all at the same distance, basically, is what you're asking?
Yeah. And how would you, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the answer to this question first, the answer to the question I asked you first, right? So what trends do we notice here? Garrett.
They're all sort of the same color, which suggests that they're the same spectral type, which sort of makes sense if they're all born at the same time.
Uh-huh. At least the ones that are bright enough to see, right, are going to be the hotter stars that were part of that. They're going to be sort of the O, B, A, F stars, yeah. There'll be M, you know, G, K, M's in there too, but those are going to be fainter and harder to see in this picture. So the fact that there are blue stars at all here means that those have shorter lifetimes, right? They have higher masses on the main sequence. They have shorter main sequence lifetimes. So the fact that there's blue stuff here at all means that this is relatively recently formed. That's one thing. So there's color, right? So blue stuff clumped together like this means that it's a relatively young cluster of stars. Relatively meaning, you know, no more than a few hundred million years. What else? Maybe you had your hand up.
I was going to say pretty much the same thing. But they also, I'm not sure if it's just how the picture is taken, but they also seem pretty pretty large compared to the other ones. So that would also be similar to, that would just support the argument that since they're blue, that they're closer to the top left of the HR diagram and have shorter lifespans.
Right. You can sort of correlate the size of the dots here with the, at least for the stars in the individual clusters, the size of the dots with their luminosity. So the brighter ones are going to look bigger, and so there's fewer of those than there are of the smaller ones.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's following that initial mass function there again. So you have fewer bright things, fewer massive things, more lower mass things, and even more low mass.
It's like another trend, yes, it's just like the distribution, like you can sort of see where like the center of the clusters are, and it looks a lot more dense there than it gets less dense towards the edges of the cluster.
Yeah, there's sort of a trend in density where the densest stuff is in the middle, right? There's still sort of that cloud, denser kernel structure. Albert? So we'll say that a cluster is gravitationally bound, but loosely gravitationally bound, meaning it's going to be fairly easy to pick one of those stars out from a random interaction with something else. But generally, I would say that this is in equilibrium, the same way that the solar system, right, is sort of in equilibrium. Things are in roughly stable orbits in isolation. But if you threw a big heavy thing through it, it's like bowling. They're gonna go everywhere. Garrett?
So if they're like gravitationally bound, do they like all sort of orbit around where the center of the cloud was? Or do they
There is a center of mass to this, and that's sort of the reference point that everything is orbiting around. And of course there's also this is full of binary stars too. Right? So Sophia?
Can you have binary clusters, like clusters that orbit each other, like are bound?
These are close enough they could possibly be. I don't know if they are.
Like, is that not something that's studied, or you're just saying you don't know about these two?
I don't know specifically about these
two,
but
no,
they're, you know, they're roughly next to each other, so they could be very slowly orbiting around each other.
Yeah. Like, that's a thing,
John. Yeah. There's nothing saying that can't happen.
Okay.
Stars that aren't in clusters. We're going to talk about that, or like, how did that happen?
Stars that aren't in clusters?
Yeah, is it just like a smaller cloud?
Just sort of the soup of the galaxy, basically, is what that is, and we'll come to that sort of slowly over 222. As far as your earlier question, we'll come back to it on Wednesday.
Okay.
We'll talk about how we know this stuff is all at the same distance, how we can match that up with the evolution stuff we talked about, and figure out
how things move around on HR diagrams and things in here. So, see you all on Wednesday. 10% battery remaining.
Hours for me tomorrow, but you know, email me.
Oh, right. I didn't mention this at the beginning, but homework 5 is now due on December 1st and not a week from today. So enjoy your extra time. I did.
Okay. This is an interesting dialogue. I also had a question on, you kept mentioning